An interview with Professor Howard Scarrow of the Department of Political Science, Tuesday, November 22nd, in my office.
All right.
What is day chilly these days?
Kind of yak in my college, Hampton, Connecticut.
I'd forgotten all about him until I see his name there. My gosh, that is out of the blue.
A strange looking person.
Is he?
Big beard.
Yeah.
Anyway. Let's go through a few of these questions. Your name, department, rank, or position now?
Well, now, Howard Scarrow, Department of Political Science, and I'm a full professor.
Right. What year did you come to Stony Brook?
It was January 1963.
January?
February. It was mid-year.
Mid-year.
Right, and that's why my 25th year, I've just been notified. Also, another thing, Carol, you would very much remember. This very day, 25 years ago, you know where you were? I was attending executive committee meeting of the faculty then, and I was faculty secretary or something. I remember you came in and said the president had been shot.
Is that right?
Yeah. Is that?
Must have been.
Am I right on that?
Yes, I think I was there.
I know that you're the one who relayed the message to me.
Yes.
But then the problem, I wasn't, I'm wondering, did I come, therefore, did I, must have come in January. Well, wait a minute. Yeah, that's right, because you asked me when I came, that was January 63. Yes. He was shot in November 63.
Yes.
By which time, I had assumed the august position of secretary to the faculty, and
right.
That gave me entree, that may be part of the executive committee.
Yeah.
And,
right.
And I very much remember we were sitting in this library in its old configuration, and you had been called from the room, presumably, by a phone call, and you came and announced to those of us who were sitting there that the president had been shot. And I think we dismissed the meeting at that point. Yep.
I remember I wrote a little statement, and it was put on the bulletin boards.
Uh-huh.
And Dave Tilley told me subsequently that statement did more to make the students look differently at the administration, more favorably at
uh-huh.
the administration,
uh-huh.
than anything that had happened up to that point.
That's interesting. Yeah.
I remember the students wanted to plant a tree somewhere
uh-huh.
out in one of the dormitory, I think it was G. Dorn, they wanted to plant a tree outside the cafeteria, I think. And I went out there and stood with them.
Incredible the impact that thing had on all
of them. It had a tremendous impact.
And I remember last night as we were watching the program on Channel 13, I asked Rowena and also my son who's home now, what if a president was shot today, whether it's Bush or Reagan or anybody, Carter, would there have been that impact? We'll never know until it happens again. But there was something about that period that was just incredible.
I think that Kennedy had gotten across to the American people a certain kind of idealism with respect to the country and what was expected of the citizenry.
Mm-hmm.
Primarily from his inaugural address.
Mm-hmm.
And we were all caught up in that euphoria isn't quite right, but caught up with
the spirit.
The spirit,
yeah.
Yes.
That's right.
Yeah. Now, I don't think that in some ways Bush's has not gotten across yet. I think he may.
Mm-hmm.
Something depends on how he handles himself. Reagan's being shot, and the way he took it came close to getting across to the country that here's an individual who is courageous.
Mm-hmm.
And humorous, doesn't take himself too seriously.
Yeah.
But these things come out in ways and under circumstances you don't.
That's right.
You can't foresee.
Yeah.
So you came in January.
January 63. Yeah. 63. Right.
How old were you at the time?
Well, let's see. If I've been here 25 years and I'm 60, I guess that made me.
45.
Well, no, 35. 35. Right. Yeah, 35. That shows how our arithmetic is. 35. Wow, a youngster. And I came from Michigan State, and the reason I had started mid-year is that I had a Social Science Research Council fellowship to take me to Canada. I didn't want to give that up, so we had spent the fall semester doing research in Ottawa, and then we came down here. And so when I had visited in the spring of 62, I visited the campus at Oyster Bay. And so when I arrived, I came to the campus at Stony Brook.
Yes.
Now, Martin Travis had drove me out here in the spring, or had done, anyway, I had seen the bulldozers at work, so I wasn't totally.
Who was responsible primarily for your coming?
Well, it was Martin Travis. I was his graduate assistant at Duke University. And so when I learned that he was chairman, actually, I had occasion to correspond with him when I thought he was still at Stanford, and the thing got forwarded to him, and he wrote me back, by the way, I'm here at Stony Brook, which, of course, I never heard of. Or actually, it was in Oyster Bay, but et cetera, et cetera. And he said, I'm chairman, and would you like a job? And, well, I thought about it, and I was, as I say, I was at Michigan State. There were several factors there I didn't particularly like, and also it wasn't 100% certain I was going to get tenure, so I had to sort of say, well, do I take a chance, or do I want to go or not? So I said, well, why don't I look at it anyway? Frankly, I thought Long Island and Staten Island and Manhattan Island were more or less synonyms for a skyscraper country. And of course, I came out and saw Martin's beautiful home in Oyster Bay and saw that Long Island was indeed not the same as Staten Island or Manhattan Island. And so that sort of convinced me. Also, the weather was a beautiful day like today rather than the cloudy Midwest. So everything combined to make me think, my gosh, maybe I should do this. So I accepted the position with the caveat that I could continue my plans to go to Ottawa, which I was going to, you know, spend the fall semester there. So that's how it happened, a sort of providential series of accidents, really.
How did you know Martin?
Well, he was at Duke University when I was a PhD graduate student.
I see.
And I was assigned to him as his grader. I graded a couple of papers for him. He didn't work me very hard, for which I was very grateful. So we met at Duke, and then he left Duke and went to Stanford, and then Stanford, he came here.
Was Waldo Beach at Duke?
Yes, he was. He was indeed. I remember the name. In the religion department. Yeah.
He's just retired.
Oh, has he?
Yeah. I knew the family. I knew his older brother. And his younger brother. And his middle brother. Number six. Number five. Anybody else interview you?
No. Well, I remember we had dinner with Harry Kalish when I came out. So the three of us had dinner, and so Harry was one of the salespersons who tried to convince me what a great place this was. So that was a lot of fun. And
Ross?
Stan, I'm trying to think. I don't think. Maybe I did meet Stan Ross, but he, of course, he was just a professor of history then. He didn't assume his administrative job until later. I probably did. My recollection of Stan is so strongly influenced by his subsequent activities that I sort of blurred out whether I met him at that one visit or not.
Okay. Let's see. You're talking about a visit in 62?
Yes, that would be the spring.
Oh, Stan.
Well, maybe he wasn't even here.
He wasn't here then.
Yeah, because I did. All right. That's right. You're right. It was this tremendous turmoil with Lee, was that his name?
Yes, right.
In fact, I think that's more or less all Kalish and Martin talks about while I was sort of listening to the infighting or whatever you want to call it that was going on at that point. Yes, that's right. So. It was just a transition period, very much so. And but
you came in the winter of 63.
Yes. So you must have come just in the fall.
I came in September.
Of 62. Yeah.
Right.
So you had been here only 3 or 4 months by the time I arrived.
Right. Okay. Have you explained that six to your...
Well, I think, why did I come? It was a combination of positive attraction here plus some negative factors at Michigan State, not the least of which was the lousy weather. Being a Michigander, I know exactly what Michigan winters are like. And so that was one factor. A lot of, then as I say, the uncertainty of whether I had tenure, I had to sort of take a chance on that. Conceivably I would have, conceivably I wouldn't have, but...
Did you come with tenure?
So I came, and that was one of the factors, that understandings, that I don't know if it was formally, but the understanding was that would be implicit, that I would get it ultimately.
Mm-hmm.
I remember discussing this with a colleague at Michigan State, whether I should come or not, and he said, and he's still there, Joe Schlesinger, he says, you know, tenure is a fiendish device invented by universities to keep people at the university. Because he said the worst thing that can do to a person, but the best from the point of view of the university, is gives people tenure, because it immediately sets in inertia. Why do I want to leave? But as long as you don't have tenure, you're just uncertain enough that you're willing to take chances, to go places. As it seems to me that, there's another thing, plus the fact that the salary was going to be considerably more. I think I was earning $4,500 at that point, which was a fairly good salary in those days. I mean, I had a friend of mine at Ann Arbor, was making $4,000. We both had graduated the same time. Michigan State salary were $500 more that beginning instructor level. Or by that time as assistant professor, and so I think I got out here though some fantastic salary, like $6,500 or $7,000. I don't know. Exponentially, it just seemed incredible increase when you were thinking in terms of maybe a $50 increase 1 year, or maybe if you're really good, you get $100 or $200. My gosh! All of a sudden, your salary practically doubles. So all those things sort of combined. To say, well, let's take a chance and go out.
So they all, those factors all
Yeah. I mean, I think putting an order, knowing someone like Martin here, so it wasn't completely strange. Two, sort of the excitement of a totally new, after all, Michigan State was founded, the first land-grant colleges in 1845 or whatever it was, and that place is thoroughly established, you know, 30,000 people, even then, now it's more like 50, and it was, you were part of a huge institution, you never got to know anyone, hardly knew people in your department, you had about 30 or 40 people you didn't even met, then you come out here and you meet everybody, everyone's in one building, but all departments are in one building, and it was just such a totally new experience. It was sort of a challenge, and so that, and then plus, as I say, the salary, and then the uncertainty of tenure, and weather, all combined.
What was your understanding of the purposes behind the creation of Stony Brook?
Well, I remember that very vividly because they were Harry Kalish and Martin told me how it started out to be a teachers. College, and the mandate was totally changed, and that was behind the and expanded, yeah. Right, and they're coming out here, and that was behind some of the turmoil at the time. Some people had been recruited on the understanding that there's going to be a certain type of college, and then all of a sudden it was to be a graduate center with a rather totally different mandate. And so, although I had no illusions as to what the mandate was by the time I was on board, it was going to be a graduate center. One of the four centers, yes. And that was made, but in fact, that, frankly, that was one of the positive aspects. Had it been its original purpose of just a four-year college, that wouldn't have been nearly so attractive to me, so that was a plus.
Mm-hmm. Right. What were your impressions of Stony Brook when you first came?
Well, as I have indicated, its smallness was such a change. We'd have lunch together, and that means history, economics, sociology, English, and everybody else would sit around the table, and that was it. and that was such a wonderful experience.
Where was the table?
It was in a small room over what is now the Humanities Building, but was sort of a faculty, if you call it lounge, lunchroom with a coffee pot, a round table. Probably could fit in this room very nicely. Not that everyone came at once, but because we had sort of staggered lunch hours, but you could always find a group of six or eight people representing six or so departments, and you got to know people outside your, in fact, you had to, because I, Martin and I were the only two members of political science when he started out, Merton Reichler. I guess he was the third one, and that was it. So it was hardly a big deal to have lunch with other people. You'd almost have to, just by definition. And so I think that was the overwhelming impression of its intimacy, which, by the way, extended to social occasions, too. Most notably social occasions. There were these faculty play reading groups, I remember. Yeah. Do you remember those? Were you part of those?
I never participated.
I mean, that was just wonderful. In fact, some of my, the fact that I know Natalie and Ed Feast so well today, or Tom Irvine, they all stemmed from the play reading groups. Ernie Feingold, Gene Feingold, all those people I never would have met had it not been for those play reading groups. And to this day, we remain very, very good friends. So that was the kind of thing that never had happened and presumably never would happen at Michigan State any more, Carl, than it happens at this university today.
Today,
I mean,
right.
That is the price we pay for bigness. Nothing to do about it.
I wonder.
Well, maybe you
could put our minds to it.
Maybe you can try to do something about it, but it will never recapture the days. I mean, people's living rooms aren't big enough to have a play reading group where all the faculty is invited. you just have to do it another way. But so those were my overwhelming impressions.
Did you ever come to the planning fields?
Only the first graduation was held there,
yes.
The June of 1763, which I guess was the last graduation that was held there. Or maybe there's one more.
I think they had two there.
Maybe two there. So I went to those, but only in the graduation. Of course, I've been subsequently back because of Martin Summer Institute, but yes. I never went there as part of this university in its normal.
We had the the head of the British consulate as the speaker in 63,
mm-hmm.
from New York.
Mm-hmm. I do remember that. So the other thing, of course, remember, I recall, just as small as the fact that the library was now where the lunchroom is. Your office was off the library. That was the administration building. And then that building could house library, administration, political science, history, economic, English, sociology, and I guess everything except the natural sciences. That is just right. An incredible fact. When I look at this place today and look at the lunchroom, particularly your office, because sometimes the executive committee would meet in your office. And
it's over across the hall.
Yeah. Now we need a whole building just to house the bureaucracy, which you and your secretary managed to do quite well. I don't know if there's a story in that or not. I'll leave it up
I'm
to you.
I'm trying to find Ann Jensen, my secretary. I don't know where she is.
Uh-huh.
Now.
Yeah.
I'd like to interview her. What events or persons stand or experiences stand out in your mind?
Well,
incidentally, what particular part of political science is your special interest?
Well, at that time, and still is to some extent, comparative politics, European politics, Canadian politics, politics outside the United States.
Probably following the elections.
Oh, very, very much so, yes. I've subsequently become more oriented toward American politics, but certainly at this time, that was what I was hired for,
mm-hmm.
and because other people were teaching the American stuff. And, but under the question of what events, what persons, what experiences, of course, from the early years, I suppose one thing that stands out in my mind was that, interesting, we talked about Dave Tilley. From the very beginning, this campus had a problem with students. And I think ultimately it's a problem that we've never gotten rid of, that this is almost a commuter college. I mean, that the people live in their own homes on the weekends and use this. So that's just a problem we're stuck with to this day. But I remember you, Carl, asking me to, I forget what the mandate was, but it had something to do with student behavior or something like that. And I think two things were operating here. And I'm perhaps combining this with what's happened in the next two or three years after that, perhaps even after Dave Tilley left. We're getting into a drug culture, which mm-hmm. I didn't realize we were getting into. Of course, see, coming out from Michigan, I couldn't quite figure out what was a national trend and what was peculiar to Eastern Long Island, where I happened to end up. And now I realize that that was just part of a national trend getting started. Also, and now it's coming to me, before the drugs, it was just this whole sexual revolution which was taking place. I mean, my gosh, when I went to school, and Rowena went to school at Michigan State, from whence we came, there were parochial hours, there were where men had to get out of the dormitory, and all this, that's a big campus, but that was Midwest, and undoubtedly the sexual revolution started east and went, and it took the Midwest a little time to change in the way that ultimately we all have. But I think those were certain so-called scandalous things which were taking place here. Some parents were complaining. And I, And of course, coming from my own background in Michigan State, and since this was a state university too, I took what would undoubtedly call the conservative position that this was the norm. Anything outside, this had been done for hundreds of years this way. It was still being done this way in places like Michigan State. Why wasn't it being done this way out here? Well, the answer, I think, became obvious as we now see co-ed dormitories and everything else. But we were sort of the first wave of that, and you, as administrative officer, were stuck with seeing this wave. I don't know if you knew what hit you or not. I certainly, in retrospect, did not know what hit me. And then, as I say, 3 or 4 years later, you got the same thing with drugs. And again, I didn't know, couldn't quite see this in the global perspective, which, from the vantage point of 1988, it's easy to put that in more perspective. But at the time, when you're living through it, it's tough. And Tilly was stuck with that too. I mean, he was, people like me expected him to enforce a type of behavior which we expected, yet was obviously going out of style, starting from the end of Eastern Long Island, or maybe it's San Francisco and Eastern Long Island, they sort of converged, finally caught up with the rest of the country.
One of my frustrations was that I was here with the responsibility and a kind of vague authority, but only until a president could be found. And I never knew from 1 year to the next when that would happen.
That's right.
I did not feel that I could take strong measures. By that I mean firing Dave Tilly, in whom I didn't have confidence.
Well, I suspect you didn't. Yeah.
If I had been president with both or